I've said it before and I'm saying it again. While you are out and about walking through whatever city you're in, look up at the buildings around you. Sometimes you'll see the name of a business no longer there, like a defunct bank. You may see the name of the place's builder or the year a structure was erected. You might even see a big globe with the name of a beer maker, which prompted today's topic, Chicago's Schlitz Tied Houses. I'm Tommy Henry, and this is the Chicago History Podcast. Going to talk too much about the early days of brewing here in Chicago, but if you are interested in the topic, I do have an episode on the Lager Beer Riot of 1855, which covers a lot of that topic. It is also such a Chicago story, including politicians unable or unwilling to understand the needs of their constituents. Just look for episode 412, the Lager Beer Riot of 1855, wherever you are listening to this. Although Schlitz beer was not created in Chicago, that honor goes to our friends to the north in Milwaukee, Schlitz does have many connections to Chicago. Before I get too far ahead of myself, a brief history of the early days of Schlitz beer. August Krug was a Bavarian immigrant who came to the United States in 1848 at the age of 33. Settling in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Krug opened a restaurant and a year later added a brewery. Krug soon hired another recent immigrant, Joseph Schlitz, as a bookkeeper. A few months after hiring Joseph Schlitz, August Krug died in 1856, reportedly after falling down a hatchway at his brewery. Joseph Schlitz then went from bookkeeper to taking over management of the brewery. 2 years later, Schlitz married Krug's widow, Anna Marie, and renamed the company Joseph Schlitz Brewing Company. It all sounds kind of scandalous, right? Adding to the family running the brewery was Krug's 16-year-old nephew, August Uhlein. By the way, I've heard the name pronounced as Uhlein, but I'll continue to use the very Americanized version of it. Joseph Schlitz was on a trip back to Germany in May of 1875 when the ship on which he was traveling hit rocks in heavy fog and sank. Schlitz perished along with 334 others. Upon Schlitz's death, in accordance with August Krug's wishes, management of the company passed on to Krug's four nephews. When Anna Maria Krug / Schlitz died in 1887, the Uhlein family acquired full ownership of the business, and that family continued to run the Schlitz Brewing Company for over 100 years. Brewing companies at that time mainly served the city in which they were based, but that would all soon change. October 1871, the Great Chicago Fire ravages the city. 19 breweries were lost in the blaze, with damage estimated at those businesses at over $2 million, nearly $50 million in today's money. One of those brewers, John Huck, lost not only his brewery in the conflagration, but also his home, the last structure in the city to succumb to the fire. Whether it was an act of kindness or an opportunity to gain a stronger foothold in the Chicago market, Schlitz sent beer and water to our ailing city from their brewery in Milwaukee. Now, while many have talked and written of the trainloads of beer sent by Schlitz to Chicago after the fire, this is a bit of an exaggeration. Their capacity at the time would not have allowed them to send trainloads of beer to Chicago, although they likely did send maybe hundreds of barrels of beer and water, utilizing the rails. So where did the story of the trainloads of Schlitz beer originate? No papers from Milwaukee or Chicago in 1871 or 1872 mentioned anything about Schlitz's generous gift to our recovering city, Schlitz's Chicago agent, Edward G. Uline, who was in Chicago at the time of the fire working out of a small factory on West Chicago Avenue, makes no mention of any such support in his memoirs. Some point to a Schlitz marketing campaign introduced in 1971 as the likely culprit of exaggeration. During that advertising push, Schlitz created a commemorative Schlitz beer mug, Stein, depicting the Chicago fire of 1871. People started talking of the beer and water sent to Chicago post-fire. Numbers get blown out of proportion, and misinformation spreads as quickly as a fire caused by a cow kicking over a lantern. See what I did there? In Edward Uline's memoirs, he emphasizes that after the events of October 1871, the company found new business opportunities in Chicago and that Schlitz's business here, quote, literally exploded, end quote, after the fire, and that, quote, orders came in so quickly that it was impossible to fill them all, end quote. Schlitz wasn't the only company to hurriedly begin shipping beer to Chicago, but you get the idea. Not long after the Great Chicago Fire, Schlitz began promoting their product with the line, "The beer that made Milwaukee famous." According to Schlitz, that tag developed from conversations between Baron Alfred von Kotzhausen, cool name, the president of the lithography company that made the Schlitz label, and Schlitz employee Ernest Bielefeld. Some historians, however, claim that Schlitz bought the famous line from a smaller brewer for $5,000. Schlitz began shipping their product to other parts of the country, utilizing the ginormous railway shipping yards of Chicago as their expansion hub. Between 1883 and 1885, the Chicago City Council increased the saloon license from $50 to $300. I covered this in the Lager Beer Riots episode, but I mention it here as this also made smaller saloons more willing to support whichever brewery would help them cover the cost of this massive jump in their expenses. In the early 1890s, English investors of larger Chicago breweries looking to force out the independent brewers and increase their profits brought the price of a barrel of beer down to $4 with a 50-cent rebate if needed to secure the sale. This was roughly half of what a barrel had recently sold for in Chicago. The bigger guys with their deeper pockets could afford to play the long game. Another part of the plan among the larger breweries to increase sales was to create tied houses in Chicago. By pooling $6 million, this group planned to buy up saloons around the city in which to deliver their products to the masses. The saloon would be tied to the brewer, serving only their products. This was not a new idea. It had been in use in England for decades. No longer would breweries have to worry about winning over small saloons by cutting their own margins. They would control their own bars and the products within. The English consortium found eager saloon owner wannabes willing to help with their tied house efforts. Fortunately for them, it was easy to open a bar back then as liquor licenses were not difficult to obtain as long as you had the money. The overseers at the breweries would often furnish new bars with everything they needed to run a spot, including the booze, barware, and signage. Interestingly, saloons would often do without furniture in their establishments, but in many of the neighborhood bars, wives would sometimes accompany their husbands to the local establishment for a Sunday drink. As women were not allowed to stand at the bar, tables and chairs were needed for the female customers. Seeing the tied house concept as an approach that would benefit Schlitz as well, Edward G. Uline, now calling the shots at the company, began an aggressive tied house effort starting in 1897 that would last until 1905. These Schlitz tied houses wouldn't just be any old saloon. They'd be well-designed and built primarily in industrial areas near neighborhoods with large numbers of thirsty immigrant workers. Mm-hmm. Schlitz-Tide houses often feature the brewery's belted globe insignia prominently on the facade of the building. The design of the globe dates back to Schlitz's display at the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago and was designed by a Chicago sculptor named Richard Bach. Bach described his original design for the belted globe in his memoirs, published by his daughter in 1989. According to Bach, "There was an exhibition piece I needed to do for the manufacturer's building, the Schlitz Brewery trademark of a huge globe with a buckled belt around it. The globe was supported by four female figures in playful poses, representing the four hemispheres. At their feet were gnomes. Flanking the centerpiece were four pedestals constructed of beer kegs, three to a pedestal, and on top of each a herald blowing a trumpet." According to the Rand McNally Guide, A Week at the Fair, published in 1893, "The Schlitz Brewing Company has a display consisting of a huge cask with an opening on the main front like a railway ticket window. At its two entrances are arches of beer kegs, and at each corner, columns of beer kegs surmounted with globes upon which stand staff statues. Above the cask in its center is a globe of staff 17 feet in diameter, upheld by four female figures of gigantic size. The equator of the globe is marked by a double line of colored lights. There are, about the corners and angles, 12 dioramas showing the brewery, and in one end of the cask a 9-foot canvas panorama. The cask is of antique oak, with handsome hand carvings." Other beer companies at the 1893 World's Fair included Anheuser-Busch, the Stroh Brewing Company, Pabst, and, for those of you from the St. Louis area, the Lemp Brewing Company. While other breweries also put their names up on the sides of their decidedly less impressive Tide House buildings, none have stood the test of time in the same numbers as Schlitz. A little more context for you. By the close of the 19th century, Chicago was not hurting for bars. In the early 1900s, Chicago had more than 8,000 saloons. Not quite one on every corner, but that is roughly nine times the number of bars today. The number of drinking establishments in Chicago hit its peak in 1905 when the city had 8,097 saloons, which amounted to one bar for every 239 residents. Now, before I talk about a few of the Tide houses around Chicago, I will point out that the rise of brewery monopolies and the overwhelming number of saloons around Chicago helped give rise to the temperance movement and then to Prohibition. During Prohibition, many breweries went out of business. Some were able to pivot, making non-alcoholic beer, soda, cheese, and, in the case of Schlitz, then calling itself the more acceptable during Prohibition moniker, Schlitz Beverage Company, a cereal beverage, and chocolate bars. After Prohibition was repealed in 1933, revised state and federal regulations of the alcohol industry prohibited breweries from owning or having financial interests in retail establishments, which prevented the reestablishment of the Tide House system and those monopolies. The system was replaced with the current three-tier system, with an independent wholesale distributor placed between the brewer and the tavern owner to try to keep things on the up and up. We'll be right back.
Are you a Caribbean American? Are you looking for a podcast that truly speaks to your culture and identity? Look no further than Carry On Friends, the ultimate destination for all things Caribbean American, hosted by me, Carrie Ann. Dive deep into topics such as culture, heritage, and everyday life through the unique lens of the Caribbean American experience. You'll walk away feeling more connected to your roots. Follow and listen on Apple Podcasts so you'll never miss an episode of Carry On Friends, the Caribbean American Experience. Your Caribbean American community awaits.
One of the more interesting tide houses I read about while researching this episode was across the street from the Chicago Union Stockyards, just south of Root and Halsted. Big Jim O'Leary's Horn Palace was owned by the son of Catherine O'Leary, according to author Bob Skilnick in his book Beer, A History of Brewing in Chicago. The Horn Palace had a white buff stone facade and a huge slit sign over the entrance. In addition to the ornate barroom and billiard parlor, it had a concert hall that could accommodate 1,000 attendees. The establishment also offered baths and barbershops for all the stockyard workers visiting after the end of their shifts. And because Chicago, it also had a clandestine area for gambling. That tide house was demolished long ago. There is a tide house on the southwest corner of Belmont and Levitt, west of Damon Avenue and east of Western. This location, designed by architect Charles Thistleu, was built in 1903 and originally catered to the German population of the North Center neighborhood, many of whom likely worked at one of the numerous brick-making factories of the area. Easy to spot, the building has dark brown glazed brick at its base, with a lighter yellow-faced brick above. The corner turret, with its pressed metal classical decoration, includes a well-maintained and in-color Schlitz-belted globe toward the top of the turret. Currently used as an independent bakery, it was recently a Starbucks, but has had many lives since it was built, including Hoag's Tavern in the 1910s, and was a Miska's liquor store from the early 1940s until the early 1970s. Just south of Foster at 5120 North Broadway at Winona Street is another former Schlitz tide house. Built in 1904 by architect Charles Thistleu in the Uptown neighborhood, this one incorporates German Renaissance revival and Queen Anne styles in its features and includes a corner turret with lunettes at the top. The Schlitz belted globe is on the east wall facing Broadway. Just 4 years after completion, a one-story addition was added to the rear of the structure, extending the Winona elevation by 25 feet. The name of the architect for this addition is unknown, but based on the date and style, most in the know believe it was also Charles Thistleu. Soon after opening, the building was known as Winona Gardens, Winona being the cross street, and allegedly became a destination for actors such as Charlie Chaplin, Gloria Swanson, and Francis Bushman, who were working at the nearby SNA studios. Winona Gardens did get an addition and some alterations in 1934 and 1935 by someone called W.C. Presto. I like to think he was an architect and a magician. Winona Gardens had a nearly 40-year run before being sold in the early 1940s. The classified ad promotes its dance floor, large dining room, and summer garden. In mid-1946, it was called Hugo's. Then, in November of the same year, it was going by Rudy's Old Winona. 2 months later, it was up for sale again. By 1949, the former Schlitz Tide House at 5120 North Broadway became Howie's Restaurant, phone number Long Beach 18581. And starting in 1958, it was Azuma House, billing itself as, quote, the only authentic Japanese restaurant east of San Francisco, which had a roughly 30-year run. That building is currently home to the Southeast Asia Center, offering social services, including ESL and preschool, to the neighborhood's large Asian population. It was designated a Chicago landmark on April 13, 2011. Another surviving tide house is in the Westtown area at 1801 West Division Street. With industrial development along the north branch of the Chicago River booming in the late 1860s and 1870s, many factory workers settled in the Westtown area. After the Great Chicago Fire, those interested in building less expensive wood frame houses, which at the time were outlawed within established city fire limits, they headed to Westtown. The Division Street Horsecar Line opened in 1886, which offered public transportation to those in the area, and just 4 years later expanded to provide service to downtown. In 1896, streetcars replaced those horsecars. The following years saw an influx of working-class Polish immigrants, and soon the commercial area around Division and Ashland became known as the Polish Downtown. By 1900, nearly 25,000 Polish immigrants lived within a half-mile radius of this intersection. The Tide House at Division and Wood was designed by architect Fritz Lang in 1900 in a German Renaissance Revival style. That one features a warm yellow brick face with dark red brick at the storefront level piers. There is an elaborate corner turret in pressed metal with the entrance to the pub located beneath. Look toward the top of the building facing Division Street, and you'll see the colorful Schlitz belted globe rendered in painted terracotta. The Westtown location, designated a Chicago landmark on May 4th, 2011, now houses Max Wood Grilled, and yes, they do offer Schlitz in 16-ounce tallboy cans. Two of the more recognizable Schlitz Tide houses are barely a half mile apart. On the southeast corner of Southport and Belmont in the Lakeview neighborhood is Schuba's, currently a bar and a music venue. The architects of this German Renaissance revival, built in 1903, were from the firm of Frohman and Jebsen, who reportedly designed more than 25 buildings for Schlitz. A few years back, they closed their attached restaurant called Harmony Grill, and after a renovation, reopened a brand new space called, appropriately enough, Tide House. Not only does Schuba's feature a Schlitz belted globe on not one but two of their outer walls, they also have a neon Schlitz sign on the Belmont Avenue side and a variety of Schlitz paraphernalia inside. Just up the street at Southport and Henderson, less than a mile from Wrigley Field, is another Tide House, which for many years was the home of Southport Lanes. The original bar was built around 1900 by the firm Clay and Lang, and originally went by the name The Nook. When Prohibition arrived, the bar closed briefly, and in 1922 added hand-operated bowling lanes. On the north side of the building is a colorful Schlitz belted globe. In the Bucktown neighborhood at 1944 North Oakley is, you guessed it, another Schlitz Tide House. Factories along the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad tracks and the Chicago River in the eastern section of the nearby Logan Square community brought a sizable number of Swedish and Norwegian immigrants to the area around the mid-1880s. Another significant employer in the community was the Lyon and Healy Piano Factory. The addition of horsecar lines established along Armitage and Milwaukee Avenues circa 1877 to 1878, provided the neighborhood with limited transit options, but within a few years, the elevated line to Logan Square and the extension of several surface lines in the 1890s improved things significantly. The community began to develop rapidly. The Tide House at 1944 North Oakley is a beauty. Built in 1898 by the firm Clay and Lang, it is also in that German Renaissance Revival style, with a projecting bay window and pressed metal ornament. It also has a Schlitz belted globe insignia, rendered in painted terracotta on the Armitage side. A few weeks back, I headed south to see a few more Schlitz-related buildings, including the former horse stables at 113th and Front Streets and a former Tide House just down the street at 114th and Front Street. These are two remaining buildings from Schlitz Row, an area of bars built just outside the dry industrial town of Pullman. At one point, there were reportedly three Tide Houses, the stables for the horse-drawn delivery wagons that carried beer to saloons, and housing for Schlitz workers. The horse stables still have their original terracotta horse heads, visible from the street. Both buildings were completed in 1906 and were designated Chicago landmarks on July 6, 2011. Another of the Schlitz Tide Houses is in the Eastside community area at 94th and Ewing. benefiting from its proximity to the intersection of Lake Michigan and the Calumet River, this area began to develop with the growth of the surrounding steel mills and other industries. Early residents were primarily German and Swedish, followed by Central and Eastern European groups such as the Slovenes, Serbians, and Croatians. When this tide house was built back in 1907, it was near companies like Youngstown Sheet and Tube, Republic Steel, Great Lakes Dock and Dredge, U.S. Steel Southworks, and others, each employing thousands of workers. A few years later, a new wave of immigrants came to the east side, including Italians. This two-story tide house, designed in the Queen Anne style by architect Charles Thislew, may not be as well-appointed as some of the others, but it does have a fun history. In the late 1940s, it was known as Club Silo, run by the four Popovich brothers who worked at the local industries during the day, then tended bar at Club Silo at night, and also played Serbian-American tambura music. The Popovich brothers hosted a number of local fundraising events. In November of 1946, a benefit was held at their Club Silo Tavern at 94th and Ewing, with proceeds going to, quote, Mrs. Bugis, whose husband died recently, end quote. One of the awards at the benefit, a 16-gauge shotgun. After the Popovich brothers moved on, it was known as the Bamboo Lounge for many years before closing. Fortunately, the building caught the eye of Chicago native Mike Medina and his wife Laura. Medina gave me a tour of the building and let me see their progress during our chat. Medina admitted, in addition to the slowdown caused by COVID, supply chain issues and the increase in the cost of building materials has slowed things down. Still, his enthusiasm as part of the history of Schlitz's Tide Houses in Chicago is evident. He wants that old Tide House to once again be a destination for fans of history and those looking for a cold glass of Schlitz beer. For TV fans, some scenes for the fourth season of the FX TV show Fargo were shot at the bar and in the surrounding neighborhood, according to Mike Medina. As the show was set in Kansas City in the middle of the last century, producers of Fargo were scouting locations for a, quote, well-worn building that looked like 1950 without having to do too much set dressing, Medina said. In addition to being declared a Chicago landmark in October of 2020, the 10th Tide House to be declared as such, the building in 9401 South Ewing was listed on the National Register of Historic Places on December 20th, 2022. While some Schlitz Tide Houses have been well preserved, many have been altered over the years but still have a place in Chicago's history. At last count, there are at least 41 Tide House buildings known to have survived in Chicago. In addition to the ones built by Schlitz and other Milwaukee-based brewers, there are several constructed by local brewers such as Atlas, Burke Brothers, Fortune Brothers, Gottfried, Peter Hand, Standard, and Stege. I'll have a list of locations where you can look for them at ChicagoHistoryPod.com. If you're interested in hearing about Schlitz's problems in later years in more detail, check out the Spectacular Failures podcast. I'll have a link to that in the show's notes. Thanks for listening to today's episode about Chicago's Schlitz Tide Houses. This episode was researched, written, recorded, and edited by me, Tommy Henry. Special thanks to Mike Medina for giving me a tour of his Schlitz Tide House at 94th and Ewing. Whenever it is ready, I'll be there opening night with a group of friends and hopefully a bunch of you listeners. If you want to help out the podcast, please like, rate, and review the podcast and tell a friend. It helps us get the word out to fans of Chicago history. There are links to books and other items related to Chicago's amazing history in the show's notes if you or someone you know is a history nerd like me who would like to learn more. Anything ordered through those links, not just the items listed, may earn a small commission for the podcast and help offset production costs at no additional cost to you. The original art for the Chicago History Podcast used on these social media pages was created by John K. Schneider. You're the best, Johnny. He can be found at Angel Eyes Art JKS on Instagram or via email at angeleyesartjks@gmail.com. Check out the Chicago History Podcast Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram pages for articles and pictures related to this episode and past episodes posted throughout the week. I will be back soon with more stories from Chicago's history. Until then, get out and explore when possible. Learn more about whatever city you live in, and stay safe.